Hello, my name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela. And this is Wicks and Candles, a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period films.
We want to dig into our favorite films and review them, find out why we love them, how they shaped us, what effect do they have on us.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wigs and candles.
In this episode, Sense and Sensibility. So, Gabby, the most classic of classic period films, a Jane Austen adaptation.
Yes. And we are talking about the 1995 adaptation of her novel Sense and Sensibility. And we know for period film lovers, Jane Austen is always present. So this is going to be quite exciting.
Yeah, it is. And this is it's a beautiful film and I can't wait to talk about it. So before we start the discussion, you want to share with us some facts about the film?
Sure. So this is the 1995 adaptation of Jane Austen's novel. The novel itself was published in 1811. The film was directed by Ang Lee from Taiwan and produced by Lindsay Doran and Sidney Pollack. I mentioned those names because it's going to be interesting for our discussion later on that the producers are American.
Yes.
The screenplay was adapted by Emma Thompson, who was pushed to do this by the producer, Lindsay Doran. The film was made in 65 days. I found this out in our research, and it became an international success. It was nominated for many international film awards and won many, including the Oscar for Best Screenplay, yeah, for Emma Thompson, and the Golden Globe for Best Picture. So I don't know if this is still valid up till today, but certainly for a very long while, Emma Thompson has been the only person who has been awarded an Oscar for both writing and acting. This is an interesting piece of trivia to this film. Also, what is interesting about the entire production and the film is that Kate Winslet, who was very young by the time she took part in this film, was nominated for the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, and she won the BAFTA for Best Actress in a Supporting Role for this film. So this is a short summary of most of the most interesting pieces of information about the film. So I've mentioned already two names about the cast. So we see Emma Thompson playing the leading role as Eleanor Dashwood, and Kent Winslet as her sister, Marian Dashwood. We see Hugh Grant as Edward Ferrars. And this is also a nice piece of trivia. When Emma Thompson was writing the screenplay and she was writing the character of Edward Ferrars, she immediately thought of Hugh Grant. And she knew that this has to be played by Hugh Grant. So she kind of made that character for him. And just to name a few more names that we all love from the scene, we also have Alan Rickman playing Colonel Brandon and Imelda Staunton also playing a role in the film. So it's a beautiful, very solid and 100% British high class cast.
indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like creme de la creme. Do you want to go ahead and maybe give us a short summary of the story?
Yeah, so thank you, Gabby. Yeah, so for people who have read the book, they know the story very well. But we'll do a little summary here for the movie. So this is the story of the Dashwood sisters, Eleanor, Marianne, and Margaret. And what sets the story in motion is the death of their father, Mr. Dashwood, who leaves everything, including the house where the Dashwood sisters are living, Norland Park, to his son, his first marriage. That son is John Dashwood. However, on his deathbed, he asks John to please look after the sisters and their mom. After all, he has only left them £500 a year and no dowry. So sadly, the Dashwood sister have to move out of the house so John and his wife Fanny can move in a charming small house in the country. It's called Barton Cottage, and they settle there hoping to ensure their futures are not too compromised by this move. There they meet Edward Ferrars, Fanny's brother, and Colonel Brandon. One day, Marianne goes out for a walk, and she ends up having a little accident and falling. And then we have the introduction of another major character, John Willoughby, who literally sweeps her off her feet and carries her into the house. And then after all of the characters are introduced, what follows is Austin, a classic Austin with, you know, a lot of intrigue, humor, heartache, a couple of twists, and of course, finally, a happy ending for everybody. So, yeah.
Yeah, thanks for that, Minnie. And I think what you mentioned, yeah, it gives us a nice hint to start our conversation. It is Austin at his best. This book, the entire story, and I think this adaptation is a great homage to one of her most iconic novels. Yeah.
Yes.
Because the entire production was so excellent. So how about we start talking about that?
Yeah. So I was watching the movie. I've seen this movie many times, but the very first time I watched this is the 1995 adaptation, but I saw it, I believe, for the first time in 1996. And by that time I was living in Quebec, and Quebec City is a very French city. Quebec City in Canada is a, you know, the old Quebec, Le Vieux Quebec is a typically French city. And I went to an old movie theater that shows movies in the original language. Most movies are shown dubbed into French. But I saw this one in the original English, and I was just completely swept away. Was classic of British films. I mean, he had everything. He had the landscapes, he had the buildings, he had the costumes. It was, you know, and I think this movie is the one that made me an Anglophile. I admit it. I was in the middle of Canadian French. I was like in the middle of the peak of French culture in Quebec, but this is the movie that made me realize that I was also an Anglophile. So it was so beautiful. And when I watched it again, I've watched it many times after, but I was watching it, I had to watch it for different reasons. I had to watch the movie with no sound, and that made me focus on the images much more. And what really struck me is how painterly they were. They remind me of classic early 19th century painting. It was really beautiful compositions throughout. So in terms of the settings, you have countryside, you know, the classic views of costume dramas, right, or period film. You have the countryside, you have the fog, early mornings, the sheep going on, you know, fields. I mean, it's all very pastoral. And I think this is actually part of the movie as well, of some of the characters. So everything classic is in this movie in terms of that setting and the views and the landscape. You are submerged in early 19th century England, like in every detail, and it's beautiful.
Very good, Nanny. I think you really pinpointed, yeah, that it really contains everything that one associates with 19th century England, yeah, these hilly landscapes and the foggy atmosphere of some scenes, and I absolutely agree with that view that some of the scenes or most of the scenes are really set up that they really look like a painting, totally, and it is really interesting to say that we think this is like the culprit of British 19th century in England, yeah? Because as we mentioned before, many key elements on the entire production were taken over by people who were not from England, yeah? So we have a producer's team from America, from the US. We have Lindsay Doring and Sidney Pollack. And we have a Taiwanese director. So if you would only read that, you would say, how do they dare to really make an awesome adaptation in 19th century England? But this is the magic, I guess, of the entire film, that they really managed with their view to transport that to us viewers, that we say, this is exactly how I imagine Jane Austen's surroundings to have been like, yeah.
Yeah.
It is really beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, I think the person that I'm on that team, of course, but I think the person that I really, really love, because I love his other films, is Ang Lee. I mean, what a master. He is a master director, and he had done a movie called Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and I think that was the movie that led the producers to call on him to direct this one. And you might think, okay, these movies are not at all alike. You know, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman is in contemporary Taiwan, and it has nothing to do with Jane Austen or 19th century society, British society. But what really attracted them was the dynamic between the sisters in that movie and the fact that this movie is about sisters. And I think that was very key. And another thing, so he brought that sensibility to the directing, you know. But the other thing is, you know, I think a lot of what period movies do is create sort of like a myth. This is about a representation of culture. This is about kind of myth making. This is Britain telling, this is what we have to offer. This is what we export to the world. They have been extremely successful, obviously, because millions of people around the world love British period films. I mean, the BBC has an entire category of, you know, costume dramas and masterpiece theater, of course. So this is an export. This is very much done for international audiences, as much as, you know, domestic audience, like British audiences. So I think the fact that you have two American producers and a Taiwanese director is absolutely fine, because they have this external view of what they think.
What the viewer expects.
Yeah, and I guess maybe some, I don't know, here I'm speculating, but perhaps, you know, a renewed sense of it. It's like, it is still interesting for them. It's not, they're not jaded. Like, it's still something that they can see with curiosity and admiration.
and that they're eager to consume. Yes, and I think the... while I was researching for this, I mean, maybe I have to say I saw the film also back then, maybe also after it was so popular with the Oscars. So when the hype was going on and it became so famous. And I have seen the film now again in preparation for our podcast. And while doing the research for the entire film, I heard some interviews and some interviews with Lindsay Doran saying that she loved it, even though she's American. She spent many, many years in England, and she loved everything about it, and she loved Jane Austen. So she was also like trying to give that, what you're saying, yeah, this is like, I am a consumer of this export.
Yes.
How does she put that into the filmmaking? does she transport that love that she personally feels towards this culture and all these elements, how she puts it even through the film. And interesting also that Ang Lee himself, he says, up to that moment when he was approached to do the film, he says, I didn't know anything about Jane Austen or England in the 19th century. So he had a very unbiased imagination and a view of, okay, how do I put this marvelous script into moving pictures?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And a master director. I mean, every frame of this movie, and again, it was interesting to watch it. I mean, these movies are a feast for the eyes and for the ears, right? Because you have these beautiful dialogues and the beautiful accents, which everything is appealing to that audience, right? That loves this. And you have the music. But it was interesting when I was watching it without sound, because I could concentrate on the images and the framing of it. Everything was so carefully structured and studied, where everybody's placed within a scene, within the spaces, so carefully constructed. Yes. And I think this is very important because we've talked about this in other episodes. We have talked about this in other, or we will talk about this in other episodes. But, you know, when we talk about period film, we're talking about societies that had different rules, and depending on class and position in society. So all of this is very important. It's like it's more important than today, because where you are sitting, where you're standing, where you're walking through, you know, is an indication of your status in society. So I think none of what we see in the screen is done without thinking. Everything is intentional.
Yes. Yes, I totally 200% agree. And I had exactly that that impression when I saw the film again, that nothing is left to chance.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Yes. All these frames, all this choreography of, okay, you come in and so on and so on. It's just really so, so carefully studied. And, we have mentioned this, and you said it at the beginning, as a viewer of costume dramas or period films, we want to feel submerged in that time. Yeah. And we don't want anything to look anything like modern. We want it to be as accurate as possible. And this is something very, very difficult to achieve if you don't, if you don't take it seriously and really do it as carefully as they have done this. Yeah, but they don't really put any new elements, and they don't improvise and say, okay, let's make it look like, you know, we can imagine that it looked like this. No, they try to make it as accurate as possible to the times, to document these times. And this is part of the magic, that you really feel like you're submerged in those times.
Yes. They really, and you know how you can tell? You can tell by the costumes, the set design, which is exquisite set design. And I do have a few things that I want to add before we finish this section. I think very important in this movie in particular is the hairstyles. Why? Because period films, part of their magic is that they're trying to capture a period of time, and like you said, to be a part of the magic is that they're accurate. Nothing takes you out of the time. Like it's true to the period. And in this movie, you can see the hairstyles are very much, you know, the period hairstyles. They didn't try to make their actresses look more modern, more sexy, which a lot of period films try to do. And it takes you out of the period.
Yes, with too much makeup, you know, or yeah, exactly. Totally. And again, to the settings, maybe you can say something about it since you have seen it without sound, which I would really like to know why you did that. How he played perfectly, how he portrays these differences in society through the settings, yeah, that we see in some scenes, the huge, beautiful house of the Dashwoods, yeah, all the splendor, a lot of sunlight, yeah, in those scenes. And then when you see the contrast of the country cottage where the Dashwoods are supposed to move in and live afterwards, they're a little bit settled down, yeah? There's a little bit, the scene's a little bit foggier, maybe a little bit cloudier. It's all very minimalist, yeah? To kind of really make that contrast of these two classes in society more and more clear for the viewer, yeah? And more obvious for the viewer. So this cottage with very little furniture, very little color inside the house. There's very little decoration. Everything is either in white or gray. The path towards the front door of the house is just a dirt path. There's no stones or anything. And then you see the contrast to the other houses, which of course are full of decoration and expensive objects.
Yeah.
And plays that, they play with that a lot. And I think how they set to make this difference is very clear. That the Dashwoods were not so well positioned in society.
Anymore.
Yeah, anymore.
I mean they lived in this extraordinary house. It is so unfair. And the point is made like, and I think this is going to take us to the script. The point is made like right away that this is so unfair, so hugely unfair that the house where they're living, they have to move out because houses and property goes from father to son, not from father to daughter. So the son who's never lived there, he inherits this house and he has to move in with his wife whenever he pleases. And is extremely sad. The mom, we see the mom, she's extremely distraught. She has not only lost her husband, her beloved husband, she has to pack her house and leave. And the point is made at different points, you know, in the dialogue, everywhere, how yes. unfair this is. But yeah, but we see, for example, when they're still in the house, you know, they have this grand room where Marianne, the Kate Winslet character, is playing the piano and it's very beautiful and spacious. And in fact, we have this camera movement between the lower floor and the higher floor. Between characters, one looking up and down, so you can sense, you know, this is a grand house. And now they're going to this little cottage that's very small. I want to add something else before we move on to the script. This movie is full of feminine energy and feminine touches. This is a story about women. There are male characters, but this is a story about women and how women navigate society. And there's a lot of talk about economics, you know, how this impacts women, because women could not work, they could not inherit property, and they could not earn their living. This is something that the character Eleanor says, we cannot even earn our living. So this is there's a movie about women and the spaces, we have talked about this before, you and I, there's two kinds of spaces, but mainly the spaces are feminine spaces. And, you know, and when they move to the cottage, it becomes an even more intimate feminine space just inhabited by women. And then later on, we see the men coming into these spaces and the dynamic that happens when the male characters come into the space is really like striking. So I think the whole movie is just so wonderfully done. with all of these decisions.
Yeah, it was so cleverly done. Yeah.
So cleverly done.
To exactly convey exactly this feeling, this feminine atmosphere. This feminine atmosphere, this dynamic, this relationship between the sisters, and which role they played in society, and so on. It's all these elements that put you also in the time, yeah, that also show you which struggles they had to deal with as women and daughters and so on.
Yeah,
it's so cleverly done.
But now, should we talk about this screenplay? Because I think one of the most exciting, beside Ang Lee, for me, the most exciting mm-hmm. thing about this movie is the fact that Emma Thompson, this extraordinary actress, wrote the script for this movie. Why do you think this is so special?
Well, it wouldn't have been this film without the script. There is no film without a script.
Mm.
Yeah? So... the fact that she wrote this is already kind of special because she wasn't an expert. This was her first attempt to write an adapted screenplay. And also while researching, I saw a little interview of how she approached the screenplay writer of Howard's End, which she had just recently worked with. Before yes. she started doing this, and she said, "How do I do this? How do I adapt such a big novel? It's a long, complex novel." And she got some tips from the screenplay writer from Howard's End, and I think this is what made it so special for Emma Thompson, that she made such a dramatic. Usually, you know, there's a lot of drama in Jane Austen's novels. All this, how women suffered and how they were delivered to the luck of marrying the right guy and so on and so on. So these kind of heavy, long, complex plots, because there's always so many characters and so many intertwined families and so on, that she made this huge, heavy, complex, long novel into a light, funny story. Yeah, that she managed to keep all the really important elements that made this novel so special into a light and funny story. Yeah.
I think another thing that I read also while researching is that she really tried to simplify the language. Without taking it out of the period, you know, and I was, you know, when I was watching it, truly is, you really have like a sense of straightforwardness with the dialogues, and still you feel very much in the period. You still feel very much in the novel, but I think to make these characters much more relatable.
Yes, totally. I totally agree with that. Yes.
Yeah, because I think what separates us, you know, when we think of the past, we feel quite alienated. But when we try to read old texts, and we feel very alienated from the past because we cannot even understand how they speak. But she makes all the characters feel very,
very alive.
Very alive.
This is maybe the difficulty, you know, because you have very little dialogue in the books usually, and you have to create all the dialogues, and through the dialogues, then you give the characters more life. Yeah.
And this wittiness
that she managed to convey. With all these dialogues, yeah, and they're fast-paced, very dynamic, and very witty, yeah. And this is what gives the humorous tone to the screenplay.
Yeah, the movie is quite funny. I mean, there's a lot of funny moments in it, and you know, these are like top actors. So it's like it is so beautiful to see the little movement, everything, and you know, it's just subtle here and there. But I have to say, you know, Jane Austen was a you know, a very witty writer as well. So what Emma Thompson was like, she really pared down, like she really extracted the essence of all the funny, the dramatic, the into something that people can easily digest in this movie. I think she really honors the spirit of Jane Austen with the screenplay. So if we talk about the screenplay, you know, it's also how she wrote the characters too. So should we talk about the main characters a little bit?
Sure.
Do you want to start with, should we start with Eleanor, the character played by Emma Thompson?
Let's start with Eleanor. So Eleanor is the oldest sister of the Dashwood sisters. She's 19 in the book. And it is played by Emma Thompson herself, who by the time she made the film is 35 years old.
It's an interesting change, because she makes Eleanor much more mature and her situation as an unmarried woman much more urgent or distressing in a way, right? Because 19 to 35, I mean, really, it's a big difference there. But I can say that Eleanor is my favorite character in this movie. When I think of Eleanor, and I could be completely mistaken, obviously this is all speculation, but when I see Eleanor as a character, I have the feeling of seeing a real 19th century woman. I can relate to her as a real life person, where in many other movies, the characters and motivations and actions of the characters, female or masculine, are sometimes quite incomprehensible to me. It's like I enjoy, but I can't understand why they're doing this or that. But Eleanor, she's somebody like, she's so clear to me. She's so, again, relatable. It's like I understand her. I understand her emotion, her motivation. I completely can see her as a woman at the period, and I can understand that woman and the difficulties of her period, of her time, much more than in any other movie. And I think it's just both a testament of how she wrote her. She's a very, obviously she's the sense in the mm-hmm. sense and sensibility. Eleanor plays the sense. She's the sensible person. She's the one who's running the house. She's the one finding a house, the rent. She's the one keeping the books, the accounting. She's the one keeping the house running, comforting her mother. She's the eldest sister. She's the one who has to be proper. And she does this without any bitterness or resentment.
She's very composed.
She has humor. You can see her intellect coming through, but also her down-to-earth character. And I think, again, it's a testament to how she wrote it, but also how she's played by Emma Thompson. Wow, she's one of my favorite characters. I really love Eleanor.
And I think it's interesting in it, in what you mentioned about her, about the age of the character and her age as an actress. Okay? I could imagine, this is again also speculation, I could imagine that it is, of course, that way, way more clear to differentiate between her character, Eleanor, and the middle daughter, Marianne, who's played by Kate Winslet, yeah? To make this age difference a little bit clearer, that she was the older and Marianne was the middle sister. Okay? Otherwise, if they had really picked up, a 20-year-old actress, maybe this difference in age wouldn't have come through so clear. Mm. And yes, and this maturity of Emma Thompson as a woman and as an actor go along very well with Eleanor's position within the family. Yeah, what you say, yeah, that she was responsible for so many things within her family. I think it is only of an advantage if it is played by someone who has more experience in life already. Yeah, you can give this sense of, okay, I am not flying around through life, you know, trying to discover things. I am kind of become more settled because I am not 18 anymore.
Yeah, not only become, she has to. She simply has to. And that they just lost their dad. So yes. She becomes kind of the de facto head of the house after they lost her father, right? So she is not so much that she has to become, she has no other choice.
So she is sense. She is complete sense. She is she struggles to show her feelings and her emotions, even though she has many. So she always tries to play the rational one between the two sisters. While Marianne Dashwood, her sister, played by Kate Winslet, is obviously sensibility. She is just a volcano of passion and emotions.
We were talking about volcanoes earlier, but in a much different context.
Yeah, so tell me about your impression of Kate Winslet, very young Kate Winslet, playing this role.
Wow. So this is 2 years before Titanic. This is pre-Titanic Kate Winslet. So there will always be a before and after, right? Oh gosh, she's so... I mean, the thing with Kate Winslet is that she's also a very down-to-earth actress. She's also a very earthy, I will say even more earthy than Emma Thompson. Emma Thompson still has a lot of, you know, she's more like a cerebral, still has more a cerebral vibe than Kate Winslet. But this is not the role she's playing here. She's playing a romantic young girl who, you know, he's quite passionate. She wants more out of life. She wants to feel. She wants to feel. And the interesting thing about how Kate Winslet plays this is that you take her seriously. She's not a silly girl. She's not
because
silly.
She's very intelligent, very well educated.
Oh, yeah, she's well-read, she plays piano, she's very well-educated. So she's not silly, she's not superfluous. She just wants a lot of feeling. She wants to feel things, and she wants to be moved. And more importantly, she's not going to hide the fact that she's moved by things, by love, by beauty, etc.
Yes,
what
it's
do
very,
you think?
Yes, totally. She really... expresses all her emotions and all her thoughts. She is not shy to really say or show what she really feels. Of course, in all the decency that she was brought up to keep within her society frames. But she is, if she feels joy, she shows joy, with her eyes, with her smiles, with her gesture, with her voice, how she giggles, how she sings or approaches people, And there is a scene where her movements, she cannot really compel herself, just like, Eleanor, she's full of emotions inside because Eleanor is going through a rough phase, one can say, kind of brokenhearted and feeling deceptions through many things, and also the loss of her father, but she's very compelled and just very composed. She doesn't really show it, but Marianne is the opposite, and she can't really keep it inside. She shows it. There is one scene in a party that they went to in London. So by this time, the love story of Marianne has already been shown. This scene, as you mentioned at the beginning, that she's taking a hike and she falls and she twists her ankle and she is rescued by a man. He really picks it
because
up. Her,
you can see her say her name, Mr. Willoughby.
This is Mr. Willoughby, exactly. I was just about to say. So she is being picked up from the ground because of her twisted ankle by a man who came on a white horse, and this is exactly John Willoughby. So by the time they meet again in this party in London, they have already met many times. She has completely fallen in love, head over heels, with Mr. Willoughby. And they have gone through little trips on the countryside, and they have, talked a lot and so on. And then there's a break in her relationship, and she doesn't hear from Mr. Willoughby for a while until this moment at this party. Yeah. So she sees Willoughby across the room, and she rushes to him, and she kind of forgets where she is in, that she is in a very high society class ball with all the people being nice and tidy and, composed and proper. Yeah. And she just walks very fast to him. And she also quakes in joy and says, Willoughby, I haven't seen you in a long time. And good God, Willoughby, and this is certainly not the behavior, not the reaction that any of the women in that room would have shown, if they would have walked very slow.
Yeah.
They would have done a little
not
courtesy
like
and so on. Yeah. And she was just like, this joy that she felt for seeing him again, it didn't stop her from expressing it among all those people who were just very calm and tidy and proper. Yeah. So this is Marianne. She's just a display of life and passion for love and beauty.
Yeah. She's spontaneous.
Yes.
She's spontaneous, and she doesn't think that there's nothing wrong with that.
Yes.
In fact, she thinks the opposite is wrong. Like when you hide who you are, or you hide your emotions.
And she really doesn't care that much about what people might think of her behavior, because she says, this is right. How I am feeling and how I am expressing it. This is the right thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, for that scene is quite, that's a quite tough scene, because by this time, Willoughby has found another woman, and he essentially has cut off the relationship. So this is a tough scene, and it's very humiliating for Marianne when she does that and he ignores her. So she also is very quick to show how distraught she is he's like, "Oh, who are you?" I mean, it's a pretty tough scene.
It's very tough, yeah.
I cannot really imagine. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the price that you will have to pay in society for behaving in a non-proper way. So I don't really know what the consequences will be for a woman who didn't behave as she was expected. She's accepted in society, but people will talk about her, I guess.
They were already whispering behind her back, yeah.
Yeah, whispering behind her back and so on. And, and everything that happens to one person of the family, affects the rest of the family. Yeah, it's not, it's like if your sister behaves in that way, they're gonna criticize your mom and everybody else. But yeah, I think we should move on to the two main male characters, because they're quite important. So, three male characters. So we have Edward Ferrer, who's played by Hugh Grant, and we have Willoughby, played by
Greg Wise,
and we have Colonel Brandon, played by Alan Rickman, the beautiful, amazing Alan Rickman. Rest in peace,
Alan Rickman. So I can say a word or two about Alan Rickman's performance, and please be my guest and talk about Edward. Alan Rickman, he is great. I mean, he's a very, he was a very expert and talented actor. Of course, plays this role wonderfully. The entire contrast of Marianne, and how he is fascinated by this explosion of life and passion by Marianne, because he is also very subdued. He's a little bit older compared to Marianne, and he has kind of a tough past behind him and so on. And of course, when we know Alan Rickman, we love Alan Rickman. And At the same time, while re-watching this film now, many years after I saw it, and maybe this was one of the first times I saw Alan Rickman back then,
yeah,
playing a role in a film, now that I see it 20, 30 years later, I think Alan Rickman was being a lot Alan Rickman. So you see, you know, how he uses the tone of his voice, and he speaks very low and slow. That became afterwards one of his trademarks. That you say, okay, this is Alan Rickman. So yeah, wonderful performance. And it's just somehow he belongs there.
Yeah, you know, of all the casting, as much as I love Alan Rickman, and of course Alan Rickman went on to play Professor Snape in the Harry Potter series, among other films. I mean, he is the main character in, he plays the main character in a movie that I absolutely love, but I cannot watch because it's so hard to watch, which is called Truly, Madly, Deeply. So Alan Rickman was just a special kind of actor. He had a depth that is quite unequal. And as much as I love him, I mean, he plays the character of Colonel Brandon perfectly. This is a dignified man, a gentleman in every sense, with a very sad past. Mm-hmm. So he has had a loss in his life. So he and he's just kind of like the perfect gentleman. He's decent. He's well placed in society. He's kind. Well, beautiful character. But the only little trouble I have, I guess this is in the novel, there is that Colonel Brandon falls in love with Marianne, and there's an age difference. And again, this is my 21st century. This is my 21st century perspective.
Okay, classes, on, yeah.
On this relationship, and that's the only thing. But
of course, you know, it is difficult for us viewers to really imagine a love relationship between a character played by Alan Rickman in the age that he was, and the character played by Kate Winslet was being 19. So, of course, it is kind of, you know, hard to kind of say, okay, this is just feels really romantic. But at the same time, it is exactly what Jane Austen wanted to show, you know, that women had to choose right, and that Marianne, at the end of the day, she had to choose a decent gentleman who could take care of her, you know?
And
you feel the awkwardness, and you feel the awkwardness of this relationship, even though they really were fond of each other, because she knew that Colonel Brandon was a good man and an educated man and a loving man. You feel the awkwardness between both of them.
At the beginning, right? At the beginning, you feel the awkwardness. At the end, you know, I think they do make it believable. I mean, you're supposed to believe that he tempers her. That he tempers her a little bit, right? She's a little bit calmer under his influence. But the thing is that she is truly loved by Colonel Brandon. But
she's what we truly haven't mentioned,
yeah, what we haven't mentioned here, and I think it's just because this is a story that everybody knows so well. We haven't really discussed like the plot very much detail. The thing is that Marianne falls in love with John Willoughby in that scene that you described. She's like, which is the classic romantic scene. In fact, I dreamed of that when I was young. I mean, that was like my dream. So there's a storm. She's walking. She's, you know, she's suffering so much, and she goes out in the rain, and then comes this man and rescues her when she falls. And she falls like head over heels, like you said, in love with John Willoughby. And like you said, he's played by Greg Wise, and he's completely the opposite of Colonel Brandon.
Colonel Brandon.
As played by this actor, Greg Wise. And I'm not very familiar with him. I've only seen Greg Wise in this movie. I don't know him. And I've told you this before. And I think he was cast perfectly. I don't trust his face.
Well, you are not supposed to trust him. Yeah, if you've watched the film till the end. you kind of then grasp, okay, I was really not supposed to trust him entirely. Yeah,
because he's so, wow, gallant, and he brings her home, and, you know, they very quickly develop like a quite intimate relationship where they're talking every day, and they're sitting very closely in the parlor. I mean, it's quite quick, like, yeah, and his face is so funny. I do not, you know, and it's good. I guess it's perfect casting because
yes, I think it's perfect casting, exactly. You're not supposed to kind of see through him.
Yeah, you never know his intentions. You really if his intentions with Marianne are true. Like you can never know. It's like you really don't know. Of course, if you are in the perspective of Marianne, she's incredible. She's crazy. I mean, she sees nothing else but Willoughby.
Of course.
I mean, but as the viewers, and you know, even in the from the perspective of Eleanor, you cannot really read that this man. Like he's young, much younger than Colonel Brandon.
He's handsome.
He's handsome. He comes in a horse, big, you know, very physical. Yeah, we talk about, you know, when we had another discussion, we talked about how in that scene when he rescued her, when she falls and he rescued her, he actually takes her shoe off and says, I have to check for bones. And he actually dares to touch her foot. And I wonder, yes. I mean, this is like the boundaries. I mean, at that time.
Okay. Yeah. And from that moment on, the entire relation was very physical, which was very unusual. And which really matches both spirits, yeah? And of course, what Marianne likes, as you mentioned, she was very earthy. She needed to feel something. So it suited her very well how Willoughby treated her.
They were the same generation. So I guess they both, you know, fulfill the spirit of romance. They believe in showing their feelings. They believe in grand emotions, grand gestures, etc.
As opposed to Edward Ferrars.
Oh, my God.
Played by Hugh Grant. Oh yeah, God. So Edward Ferrars is the
The
love interest of Eleanor. So please go ahead. Please go ahead and tell us something about Edward.
Why do I always have to start? Oh, my God.
Oh,
well,
gosh.
Should I start? I can start. Hugh Grant is Hugh Grant today. And Hugh Grant is Hugh Grant in 1995. I don't care how many collars and cravats and stiff collars and whatever you put on. He's still Hugh Grant. However, as you said earlier, Emma Thompson, the brilliant cerebral, incredible Emma Thompson, wrote the character of Edward Ferrars with Hugh Grant in mind. So we must respect her choice and her vision. And not only that, she knows what she's doing. Hugh Grant has a particular type of acting and humor that is the definition of British humor.
Yes.
It's very subtle, self-deprecating, at times clumsy, but always gracious, always, you know, a quick word. Very witty, so he's, and you know, very proper, a little bit shy. So he truly is kind of that definition of that English humor that people admire so much and love so much. So I think that's why. And to be honest with you, I do love his portrayal of Edward. The problem is we're watching this movie now.
Yeah,
we're watching it again, and Hugh Grant is Hugh Grant. And to be honest with you, at the time, he was already a well-known actor. He had done a couple of period films, including Maudie's. Emma Thompson knew what kind of actor he was, and he wrote because he knew he would bring that sensibility to the to the role. So Edward Ferrer is a man of high position. He's the brother of Fanny, the wife of John Ferrer, who inherited everything. and the reason why the Dashwood sister has to move. So he's in a tricky position. He could be the bad of, you know, he could be one of the bad ones in the movie, right? Because he's from the other family. But from the moment he comes in, he's so charming. He's so, he doesn't take himself seriously. And there's a key scene where he comes in and the little sister, Margaret, she's been missing. She's been hiding. She doesn't want to show her face because, you know, the new people have come to take over the house and she doesn't want to meet them. She doesn't want to greet them. She's, I think, 12 or she's young. And he and Eleanor find a way for her to show up. Like, they start to make this conversation and she's hiding under a table. Margaret is hiding under a table and they know that she loves an atlas and she has an atlas with her. So they start, they have just met each other. Eleanor mm-hmm. and Edward have just met each other and they both, without saying anything, they start to make up this conversation about the Nile and where it's located and being wrong in on purpose. They're saying, oh, it comes from, you know, it's in Belgium and so on, so that Margaret can get enraged and come out of the under the table. So very quickly, they connect in that way. So he's very kind. He's very thoughtful. You know, he's actually very sensitive.
He's very sensitive. But at the same time, of course, he's a very sensitive spirit, yeah? But he is, from the behavior, he is very similar to Eleanor in the fact that he's very composed as himself, you know, that he doesn't really dare to tell his mother, for example, that he actually doesn't want a serious job, that she actually would be very happy to have a more humble life in the countryside. And he doesn't really dare to do that, like maybe someone like Marianne would have done, you know. Uh-huh. So that's maybe this similarity between the two personalities of Eleanor and Edward, of course, yeah. Makes them fall for each other, yeah? That they kind of see life with a similar view. Mm-hmm. And they have also a similar struggle, you know, because he is trying to kind of, okay, he's supposed to, the expectation that they have on him, and he actually doesn't really want to. And Eleanor herself, you know, she has all the responsibility of marrying and so on. And she actually also kind of keep up and might also end up empty-handed, you know. So they share a certain struggle, they share a certain struggle and a certain similarity in personality.
So you are so right.
This is how so they match very well. I have to say, this is why I let you talk first about Edgar and Hugh Grant. That I am, of course, super biased today. We should have maybe done this podcast in 1996, because of course. I really love Hugh Grant. I mean, from the time he had his, you know, his breakthrough back then with all these films. And yeah, of course, he plays the charming, clumsy, but loving, super romantic guy. And he did this here again. But as you said, I have to, of course, be fair enough to say, if Emma Thompson chose him for this character, she really did want this, exactly this style of Hugh Grant to come through. So I am biased, but I really have to put my bias aside, because yeah, I see a lot of Hugh Grant in Edward. And maybe to wrap it up about the characters and the cast, I have to admit that I had a struggle, even though everything individually, they're all so perfect, how they perform, how the characters are, and how they are as an actor, and so on, and so on. I had, of course, my struggle to see Eleanor and Edward as a romantic couple, you know, because of course I am seeing Emma Thompson and Hugh Grant as a romantic couple, and I don't see them really. I can't really feel as a viewer that, you know, that you fall for the romantic story. As I said, in the entire setting and how the characters and how the dialogues are done and how they talk to each other, yeah, this exchange about their struggles, you know, he says, I would actually, I would be happy with a parish, and I don't want to be a big lawyer or go to military. Yeah. And how she talks, yeah, at least you have kind of a choice, even though it's not the best, but I have no choice. Yeah. So all super witty, intellectual, super dialogues. But, you know, I have a struggle to see them really, you know, like a romantic couple kissing, Emma Thompson and Hugh Grant kissing. I don't know. As a viewer, it's kind of difficult. So I have my struggles with the relationship.
Yeah, that is very interesting. That is really interesting because individually, like you said, the characters are wonderfully created, like wonderfully developed. Like I can't stop thinking about how Hugh Grant wears the costume, the period costumes. Like he's very stiff and he's mm-hmm. very like, he has this habit of holding the sleeves, which is like a very childish kind of gesture. Yes. And he does this all the time. And I'm sure he's pretty conscious that mm-hmm. he's kind of like not fully comfortable in these clothes that he has to wear. He much rather be in the countryside with much, you know, less formal clothes. Mm-hmm. So he has a lot of little details and little gestures that show that he's not really fully comfortable with the position he has in society and the expectations he has on him. But it's true. I kind of have to agree with you that his heart is like the love relationship, like the friendship is very relatable.
The friendship is relatable completely.
The love, perhaps the passion, however, they're supposed to be not very passionate, so you know, I do believe they love each other. I do believe they respect each other very much, but I mm-hmm. cannot imagine anything in the bedroom, the apartment.
Any passion. Yeah.
Any passion, so, yeah. I know that we're running a little long, but I want to talk about one last relationship that I think is very important in this movie, more so than the romantic relationships. Can I do that?
Yes, please.
This is a novel and, of course, a movie about three sisters. I think the most important, I think the true love story in this movie is between these two sisters. And, you know, and of course, little Margaret, but I think they're older, they share a lot of things. I think the true love story, the story that is the most, the relationship that you can see the respect and the deep need for each other and love and consideration and admiration is between these two sisters. And I think these two actresses really, really play this well. And for me, this is the love story of the most important love story of the movie.
Totally. Totally. And maybe here again, the difference of age comes again as an advantage, you know, to have this, the older sister kind of protecting the younger sister and the younger sister trying to give the bigger sister this feel for life, you know. And absolutely, Nini, it is a wonderful dynamic between the two actresses. And yes, maybe this is the relationship that is the core of the entire story, yeah. And how they match each other, yeah. What Eleanor is missing in passion, Marian tries to give her, and the other way around, what Marian is lacking in rationality, Eleanor tries to give her, you know,
They complement each other.
Thank you. That was what I was looking
for.
Yeah,
they both complement and complete each other.
Yes.
Yeah, it is really beautiful. And in this case, I have to say I'm biased because my relationship with my sisters, as we can see here, is extremely important. And my relationship with my siblings is the most important in my life. I'm married, I have kids, but I can't, you know, my siblings are truly the best part of my life. You know, how can I say? I mean, so any relationship between sisters, I'm quite moved. And this is a beautiful portrayal of sisterly love. And you know, for me, that's something that's really special every time I see it. And it really moved me.
Totally. So maybe this is a good hint to start talking about our favorite scenes, because I know that your favorite scene, or one of them, includes Eleanor and Marianne.
Yes. Yeah. So we have to talk about favorite things. And there's a lot of beautiful scenes in this movie. There's like fields and horses and sheep and little parlors and teas and all the classic settings for period films, all of that. But my favorite things is not the most classic period film scene. It's a scene where Marianne, because she went out for a walk in the rain after being left by Willoughby, and she gets really, really ill. And she's in bed, and, you know, they fear for her life. She has a terrible fever, and the doctor has said, well, let's just hope for the best. That's a scene where there's only Marianne in bed, unconscious, and Eleanor in the room, you know, keeping her company during the night. And this is a very striking scene because Ang Lee goes and takes his camera, and he places the camera above the bed, so you have like a bird's eye view. So you see from above and you see the bedroom, and Eleanor is just kneeling by the bed, and she holds Marianne's hand and she says, Marianne, try, please. I guess she's begging her to leave. And she's absolutely terrified. She's absolutely terrified that Marianne will die and will leave her alone. She is the life. She is the happiness to her rationality. She loses Marianne. She loses everything that's beautiful, everything that's light.
Yes.
She loses the beauty. She loses the art. She loses the romance, the poetry in her life, her companion. And for me, that scene where we see them connect, I mean, basically, Eleanor is always very composed. We don't know her feelings. She's always trying to, you know, don't show them. Here she is completely honest. She's begging her sister, please stay. It's a hard scene to watch, but it's so well done.
It's
my favorite scene. It's the most striking scene, and I really love it because it's a key scene where it shows the love between the sisters.
Yes. Absolutely, Nene. And one of the few scenes where we see Eleanor showing emotions, because there are a few moments, but rare moments. Absolutely, Nene. And apart from the fact that it is so moving, this is really so moving, with all this, you know, superficial kind of relationships and all these balls and intrigues and so on, this scene gives the story kind of like a serious moment, you know. This is like, okay, it is not all about, you know, who marries whom and so on. And are we poor or are we rich? This scene puts a lot of depth again, like, brings you back to kind of, okay, this is the important thing in life.
What is your favorite scene?
This is funny because one of my favorite scenes, of course, apart from all the beauty that we see here, one of my favorite scenes is pretty much at the end when Edward Ferrars, Hugh Grant, comes to their house to say that he is actually not married, as they assumed, but that he kind of proposes to Eleanor. You know, by this time, Eleanor was also kind of disappointed because she had heard that Edward had had an engagement and with another woman, and he wanted to fulfill or to accomplish this this promise that he had made many years ago. And she is left with these rumors that he was engaged to this woman and that he will marry this woman. And she doesn't hear from him for a while until he comes by and visits the Dashwood sisters and their mother in their house. So he comes in, and I know you like this scene because this is Edward Ferrars / Hugh Grant at his best. how he tries to tell them and inform them that no, he didn't marry at the end. He broke this engagement with the other woman. and that it's actually his brother who married, and so on and so on, and that he kind of wants to say something really important, and he is very shy and very clumsy in his movements. And he stands by the fireplace and he tries to make it very casual how he plays with a little porcelain figure, just to, you know, kind of avoid to look at them, to look into the eyes of Dashwood mother or Eleanor and so on. So he distracts himself playing with this porcelain figure. So in this scene, he then turns around and says to Eleanor, "Eleanor, I am here because actually my friendship to you is more important and I wanted to tell you." And then she starts sobbing. And he tells her finally that he actually loves her and will always love her. So in this moment, Eleanor starts crying. She finally releases all the tension, all the fears, all the disappointment that she had inside, and all this, yeah, all this heartbrokenness that she had in her inside. She finally releases it all and just starts crying, and she just lets it all out. And I felt so fascinated by this again, because it is one of the few moments where Eleanor really shows her emotions and is really a human. You know, she's really showing, okay, woman, show your feelings. Because I thought to myself, this is so interesting. I am thinking, of course, to myself, okay, I am in 2021 and I wouldn't have been maybe so, I wouldn't cry like a baby if a man comes here and says, okay, now I can finally marry you, you know. But transported to 18 something, and you are poor, and you have the perspective of spending your life alone in a rather foggy cottage, just taking care of your household, or the perspective of marrying someone, having a life, having kids, and, you know, living life, because there were no many options for women. This relief that she as a woman felt, apart from the love that she felt for Edward, the relief of her as a woman to have a choice, to have the opportunity, not the choice, the opportunity, because it was not a choice that she had to make, you know?
No.
She was not left with a choice, that she had finally the opportunity. He is here and he loves me. And on top of that, I can marry and leave my house.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great scene. And it's play for comedy. It's part of it is play for comedy.
Yes.
Yeah, part of it is play for comedy, especially in the performance of Hugh Grant and how he plays with them. I urge everybody who's listening to this podcast, please watch this movie again and just pay attention to that scene. It's quite funny. Yeah, it's play a little bit for comedy, both. Yeah, supreme actors. I mean, amazing. Yeah, I think her relief also comes from, she, like you said, she had accumulated all of this for months and months and months. I mean, even the death of her dad, I think she's finally crying for that as well. I mean, she had to assume responsibility and take care of the house and the moving and all of that stuff in the middle of her grief. So I think she's crying for her dad as well. Finally, she can,
yeah, for everything.
She can, yes, let go. She can let go. I mean, we always talk about, in other discussions, you know, a marriage of equals or unequals. And this movie, and, you know, obviously the money-wise, this is not a union of equals. But in the, you know, the how they view the world and how they move around in the world, it is a marriage of equals in terms, yes, of personality. And yes, I think what you said is so true. Like, yeah, it might seem silly.
You know, it might seem silly, exactly.
Seem
in the
silly
moment, it might seem silly.
Moment, like,
as you
why
say,
is she crying? I mean,
I'm crying like a little kid.
She's crying so much. She's crying. Okay, again, it's play for a little bit, right? But she's weeping, like she's sobbing, and she's like, oh, I can't believe it. But it's true. The choices were stark. Like, one choice was stark. Like, you want to be an old maid and you're going to take care of this house, and, you know, the few pleasures that you might have will be, you know, reading books, and who knows, taking care of your mom. And the other one is, you know, all these other possible joys, which is having children, companionship, conversations, you know, it's like, it's quite different. So you can see the relief that life, you know, she has a chance at life.
She has a chance in life. Yeah. Because as I said, it was not really a choice. It was an option, kind of.
Yeah, okay, but
so
not
either
only...
you find someone to marry or you stay at home forever.
Yeah. Yeah. And not only a chance at life, but at our life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the possibility that brings. And that's played out really, really well.
I think so too. Yeah. And even though, as you say, it might be thought of, you know, to be kind of comedian. I took it seriously.
No,
because they make it look as like you say, okay, she's really crying like a little kid. You know, she's really crying like a, I don't know. But then I thought to myself, okay, if I put myself into a position, what goes through her mind when he says this? Everything that is changing. Just by him saying, not only that I love you, that I am open for marriage, you know, like, because I am not married. So,
yeah, it is great. I mean, this movie is, now that we can start to wrap it up, this movie is quite, I say it's the most classic of classic period films, Jane Austen adaptation, but, you know, a really beloved adaptation. I really love this movie, and every time it's like a comfort food for me. It's like a comfort, like a super warm blanket that I can put on a Sunday evening, right? Like, oh, like a cozy blanket. Such a perfect movie in every yes. way.
So how many wicks and candles would you give this film?
Yeah, so our scale is from 1 to 10, 1 being not good, 10 being very good. I've been thinking a lot about the rating for this movie because, again, I just said it's like a cozy blanket in terms of costume, setting, script, acting, directing. It's just a joy to behold. Every possible way. It's like this is the little jewel of period movies. But after a discussion, I thought I can't give it. I mean, this movie deserves a 10. It's a classic.
It's a classic. And technically, you know, if we take everything individually for itself, you know, as you mentioned, these settings, the production, the directing, the acting, the scripting, etc. So each element deserves a 10.
It deserves a 10. But my rating is going to be 9.5. Why? Because of those relationships that we were talking about. That they're not fully believable in a way. It's like theater in a way where you have to, what is this phrase they say? You have to suspend your disbelief. A little bit like in theater, you know it's theater and you know that they're making believe, right? They're moving the sets around and you have to suspend your disbelief even more so than in a movie because the movie is very, you know, they try to make it very realistic. But I think this movie kind of like you have to suspend your disbelief a little bit in terms of the love matches and, you know, between the characters and the actors they chose. So that's why I'm giving it 9.5, but Ang Lee a 10. And Emma Thompson, and I give Emma Thompson like a 15.
The Academy Awards jurors should listen to us. You know, we should give Ang Lee a 10. Nene, yes. I agree, and this is why I also give the film a nine, because I when I watch it, it's a feast for the eyes, and since we love all this, since we search Anglophiles, this film keeps us, feeds our thirst and our hunger for all these cliches and all these things that we love, you know, porcelain and rooms and dresses and everything we love, yeah, and hills and countryside and so on and so on. So it is a feast for the eye and for the soul if you are an Anglophile and if you like period films. But again, this emotional part of the of the story that I, as a woman or as a viewer or whatever, you know, of course, I find it beautiful, but I cannot really identify with the love relationships, you know. If I see at the end of the film, Marianne and Colin Brandon, so Kate Winslet and Alan Rickman coming out of the church as a couple, I feel to myself like, ooh, okay, this this looks kind of awkward.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. So this is why I give it a 9.
Wow. Thank you, Gabby. I had so much fun talking about this movie with you.
Yeah, the same to me. And to review it is like to watch it again.
And that's our episode. Thank you very much for listening and stay tuned. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Books and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Wicks and Candles. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
Wicks and Candles is written, hosted, and produced by Andreina Romero and Gabriela Morgan Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rollin. The podcast theme music is the Concerto for Two Violins in D Minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.